Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting with Sarah McJulie. We're very excited to have a special guest. Today is Patrick Ness. Welcome, Patrick.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you're out here for, I suppose, the Sydney Writers Festival. You haven't just come to a Booktopia podcast, right?
Well, you know, I mean, you're the ones to pay for my flight. It could have been. I mean, sure. That's a yes. I'll go for that. It's for the tax write-off.
And I've been following you on Twitter, and I've been watching with interest the coming film of the Chaos Walking books. How heavily involved have you been in this process?
So I've written, there have been two films in my books, and the first one was Monster Calls, and I was hugely involved. I wrote every word, I was on set all the time, and I write all the way through the editing and everything. And that was such a tremendous experience, and I'm so proud of the film, and I really feel like I got really lucky in how involved I got to be. And Chaos Walking is a different beast, not in a better or worse way, it's just different. It's a much higher budget, more high-end commercial kind of film, which, again, not a snob, I love those. But the director is Doug Liman, who did Edge of Tomorrow and The Bourne Identity and that kind of stuff. And he's got a kind of an exploratory process where he'll take the script and then sort of go, let's go see what we can find. And so he has a lot of writers around him for the process, which really works for him. And so I did a couple drafts of that script early on, and I'm writing a whole bunch now. So I'm really, really involved, but it's the director's film about how is he going to find what he wants.
How's that for someone who, it's your baby?
The book is my baby, and the book remains. The book doesn't change, it doesn't get unwritten. And that's how all I ever really wanted to do in life was publish a book and hold a book of mine in my hand. And so everything else feels like bonus. And I mean, how can anyone who has had films made of their books ever complain?
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. I mean, it's so lucky and so rare. And again, I'm so proud of Monster Calls. And such a great experience. And I'm really hopeful for Chaos Walking. I'm really optimistic about all the stuff I've seen and talked about and are doing. But the book stays. Mm. I mean, it's the same stupidity about the all-female Ghostbusters.
Undo the original.
Yeah. You can like it or not like it. It doesn't erase Ghostbusters. Mm-hmm. And if you're talking about a Ghostbusters movie that is going to harm the original, that was Ghostbusters 2.
That's such a good point.
Yeah. So I'm okay. The book remains. I'm working hard to make the movie as good as I can. But the book is mine. The book is mine.
So you're walking into these onto the set, talking to directors, got the writers around. These people are now drenched in your work in a way that is kind of subjective and personal to them now. They're sort of morphing off with this version of your story. What is it like talking to someone who, I mean, you wrote a while ago, right? So you're onto some other project, your mind's in something else.
Yeah.
And these guys, you bump into them, they're just completely immersed in your past work. I'm just protective of mine.
When the book's done, I feel like I have a pretty good relationship with it, a pretty solid one, and I feel like I know what worked, what didn't, and I love it for what it is. And I always think it's kind of like how, you love your kid. You know what's good, you know what's bad, you've done your best, you love them, regardless, and you hope the world treats them well, but you will always love them. And so I always kind of have let them go by that point. It's their time to go out in the world. And people can relate to them in whatever way they like, but I will always have my relationship with them. And also, I know them really, really well. And so they ask me about, actors will ask me about characters, and writers and directors will ask me about characters, and I'll know this stuff, and I'll know why I did stuff, because I'm really rigorous with my books. Mm. And the world set up in Chaos Walking is so complicated that it needed a lot of rigor, or there would just be gaping holes everywhere. So for that especially, I have lots of answers of how do they lie, what could possibly be the reason that women don't have noise, etc., etc. I've thought these things through, even though they're not in the book. So
yeah, so all that stuff that authors have that doesn't go into the spotlight.
They better bloody have, where you can. I always think the novel feels a bit thin. Mm. It's one thing. I'm not just saying this because this is Australia, but one of my longtime favorite writers is Peter Carey. I read him, way back since I was going to Cinda. And the thing that he does, and the reason it kind of blew my mind as a really, really young writer, is that he will often, in his books, refer to events, fictional events, that happened before or after the end of the novel, that he's not writing about, and they're not integral to the story. Oscar and Lucinda is filled with that, because because it's putative the history of Oscar Lucinda about who she becomes after the end of the book. And so the idea that a book is a smaller slice of a larger imagined universe was revelatory. I thought, I love this. I love this way of working. You are seeing just a sliver of what hopefully the author has fully imagined. And I think sometimes you can tell when there hasn't been much imagining past the borders of the book.
Yeah.
But my
I think it leads into the story and gives it a groundedness.
Completely agree.
Yeah.
Because I think, and when that's absent, you can sort of go, well, what's not quite right here? And, and I think Peter Carey is a genius at that. And so I've always, always tried to fully imagine the world around it so that, as you say, everything can be informed by the decisions I've made outside the novel.
Well, Peter Carey sat in his chair, actually. So the,
not surprised.
you can feel the Peter Carey vibes coming through.
He's great. He's great, grumpy, great, great, grumpy author. Yeah. Authors should be grumpy.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's because, you know, it's sort of a dissatisfaction with the world and wanting to figure it out. And not quite set it right, because I don't think any of us think we can set it to rights. Mm-hmm. But you're grumpy about something, and there's an itch. And a novel is just a great scratching of an itch.
And do you ever finish a novel saying, I'm finished? Or do you finish a novel and go, that's as much as I can do at this present time on this project?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, you know, like I say, I really make my peace with them. I feel like I know it's good, know what I would like to do better next time.
Yeah.
And I still love them. It's the best I can do. Because there does come a point where you're just pushing the potatoes around the plate. You're not making it any better. And you've got to let it go.
Mm.
You know, I always say anybody can write a book, but only authors end them.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's great. We're going to use that quote. Yeah.
So with something like Moby Dick, which is a big fat book,
you felt that there
was an angle here that he didn't quite capture.
No, not at all.
No?
He captured every angle he intended and needed to capture.
Yeah.
And I have read Moby Dick, and I acknowledge that almost no one else has. It is one of the great unread classics because it is difficult. And there are
whale stuff.
Well, there's great long girls in it. And just long passages of not a whole lot happening, except lists of knots, and that's okay. But it is easier than you think. Having said that, that's its reputation is so difficult, but it is actually easier than that, I think.
And it's got funny bits.
Yeah, and it's exciting. And it's, you know, it's a chase. And it's engage with it. If you've never tried it, engage with it. You don't have to like it, but that genuinely, the new book, And the Ocean Was Our Sky. There you go. I've got the title. And the Ocean Was Our Sky, which comes out in September on Walker Books, illustrated by Melbourne illustrator Ravina Kai. So there's an Australian connection.
Did you search the whole world and find someone in Melbourne that just suits perfectly?
No, we searched the whole world and found someone who suited perfectly. We didn't care where she was.
Oh, great.
And that was, there's a designer in a Walker book called Ben Norland, he uncovered Jim Kay. He just found Jim Kay's website.
Yeah.
And said, I think this might work for Monster Calls. And kaboom, he's doing Harry Potter now.
Yeah.
And so
for the rest of his days.
Yeah, pretty much. Ben is just a great discoverer of talent. And Ravina had just done Tintinnabula and with Morgan Lanigan. And we thought, well, yeah, this looks really exciting. Let's give her a try. But the book actually started as a joke discussion between me and Jim Kay. And because I just said completely offhand, what if Moby Dick was told by the whale? Because it'd be really different. And that idea of who owns the truth and who owns the story is all over my books. I don't intend it. I don't start out that way. But from looking back, it's clearly a preoccupation of mine. Because in one way or another, they're all about looking askance at the story you've been told and looking at it as an angle.
Definitely. And then the rest of us just live here.
Yep.
Yeah.
More Than This Is the Same. It's all about, you know, what's the truth here? And does it matter in a way? What kind of truth matters? And, you know, The Cast Walking is about, you know, how can you lie when you give away everything, and how can you find the truth and all the mess. And I love the idea that the whale could tell the story. It would be just as true and completely different. And so where does the truth, whatever that is, rest? Does it kind of land in some kind of nexus of the two? And, you know, Moby Dick is a work, classic work of American art. And but what does the whale think of it? And that's where I started. And it got weirder and weirder from there. So it's not about the whale Moby Dick, you know. It's about some whales who hunt. And they find themselves on the trail of Toby Wick. That's my little, you know, little joke about it. Because that's how it came out. Because I said that to the gym. They could be hunting Toby Wick. And it was just a joke. And I thought, I like that. I'll just keep it. But they live in a world where gravity meets at the surface of the ocean. So men view the world one way, and whales view it an entirely different direction. Mm-hmm. And the illustrations are the world upside down, essentially, to us, but to whales it's not. And it's about a whale called Bathsheba, who is third apprentice in a hunting pod that hunts men, because men have hunted whales, and whales have hunted men since as long as anyone can remember. And they find themselves on the trail of this myth of Toby Wick.
I love this idea so much. I can't wait.
we've been lucky enough to see a tiny little snippet sample. That's where the appetite is.
We all died. Like, we were all like, it was amazing.
It was like the first time I saw any, like, the publisher first came in with Monster Calls and only had like two pictures. A bit of text. We're like, come on.
Yeah.
More than this, please. We'd have to wait months until we get more.
That's the thing. Illustrations take a long time. Yeah. As they should. Yeah. You know, as they should. So we didn't want to give Rowena's work half done.
Mm.
So we thought, why not this time when we just do the beginning, show you what it's going to look like.
Yeah.
In the first sort of four or five chapters.
So working with someone like Jim Kay with Monster Calls, and you're seeing your imagination and his imagination sort of meeting in this point.
Yeah.
I mean, those illustrations are just ridiculously extraordinary. I had one of them as my desktop for years of him coming to the window from.
Yeah, that's the first drawing Jim drew.
Yeah,
that was the test drawing.
Oh, that was
so good we never changed it.
Yeah, and just absolutely amazing. So, are you writing and working? So you've written the story and then you've handed it over, or are you involved right from the beginning together?
No, I wrote the story, story's done. And then we talk to the designers at HarperCollins and at Walker, and we start talking about where illustrations might go.
Mm-hmm.
And that's only rough, because you also absolutely want to hear from the illustrator
mm-hmm.
and what she thinks she'd love to do, you know, because that's where you find the real joy, what an illustrator responds to.
Mm-hmm.
And thinks, I'd love to draw this, and you got to listen, because that's where the real connection's going to come. And it just becomes a conversation. And she just kept delivering and delivering and delivering.
So were there times when this... Sorry.
No, you go.
Were there times when the story took an unexpected turn? But I'm just enjoying listening. So, I'm cool. But were there times the story took a really unexpected turn because of something that the illustrator put you onto? Like,
no. Because I was totally done with the story from before she started.
Okay.
But the unexpected stuff comes, like it did with Jim Kay, because I'm so not an illustrator. I can't draw at all. I mean, I say this to illustrators and they all yell at me, because it's like, no, everybody can draw. But yeah, like you know what I mean. I don't want to give away the end, but the end is is the big climax. And she just brought these ideas that I had never pictured them that way. And they were just perfect. And that's where the collaboration is really exciting. And it's where it's really exciting in the Monster Calls, because I do my best, and then somebody, an illustrator, does their best, and together we make something a little bigger, because they can do stuff I would never have dreamed of, because I'm not an illustrator. And she's like, I said, I think the one, I only suggested really strongly one or two illustrations, because I really wanted to see what she would do with it. And there's a scene where they're sailing along the whales, and they come upon a pod of another pod of whales that has been attacked and killed and hunted. And the way they find it is that the sharks who always follow them suddenly start swimming past them. And that's how they know that there's something up ahead, because the sharks are going to feed. And so I said, I'd love a picture of the sharks. And she just drew these two solid pages, which is just a solid wall of sharks swimming towards the thing. And that, you just go, from my little idea, I'd love to see sharks. This was essentially my input, and she comes up with this incredible thing, and that's where just like, yeah, okay, that takes a turn. It makes it bigger than what was in my head.
So that, it's like she's showing you a different vision of a story you've written.
Yeah,
so,
and that's that's lucky.
That's really
lucky
cool.
When you get it right,
Is that someone like the way that film does? Like, if you go and see something that's made of your work.
When it's good, when collaboration really works, that it's amazing. Because novelists are just not natural collaborators. You know, we all chose to be novelists because we could work on our own off of a boss, and that's long may that reign. I will carry on that till I die. But collaboration, when it works, and somebody is just bringing, Bayona, who directed Monster Calls, which is always something I believe, but I've never really seen it in action as much as he did, which is about ideas don't have an ego. They're good, they're bad, they work, they don't. It doesn't matter where they come from. You know, that's, you don't have to do an idea because somebody powerful thought of it. You do it because it's good, or it's, or you know, and it works. And so we would talk, and if he'd bring up an idea, and I'd say, this is why I don't think that works. He'd go, great, next thing. And I thought, that's collaboration. Because he could do the same to me. And it's, you know, it's not about somebody fighting for a personality. It's their, he's really fighting for the idea. And so he brings stuff, and it's, you know, it's great stuff. And I just think, wow, I never would have thought of that. So that's all, that's, yeah. When collaboration works, it's thrilling. When it doesn't work, it's hell on earth. But when, it's, when it works, it's great.
What was it like to see Monster Calls for the first time?
I never really saw it for a first time, because I saw lost so much of the filming, and then I would see footage, and then I'd see like an assembly, and then I'd see a cut. So I've probably seen it 35 or 40 times. I've seen lots of different sort of versions of it.
Yeah.
And while we worked through, you know, what the final film was going to be. So in a way, I never saw it for a first time.
That must be such an interesting experience.
Mm. Can I ask a couple of writer questions? We get a lot of interest in the actual practicalities of writing in these podcasts. People, writers will give us some insight on how they actually get about doing it. Mm. You're involved in a lot of different projects at the time. Do you use those other projects in the downtime? So you have your period of intense writing, and then the editing process starts, and you can then spend a bit more time doing other...
No, I mean, I don't really have any non-intense periods. The way I feel about... I always feel like I have a certain amount of good stuff a day for a project. Mm-hmm. And that usually doesn't take me the whole day, because I can't do 8 hours of solid writing on something, because I will get tired and the quality will really drop off. And so I found a war, and there's no right way to do this. I hasten to add that. Mm-hmm. You know, writers can only tell you how they write, they can't tell you how to write, so whatever works for you. I know writers who write all day, mm-hmm. and great. It's not for me. I have found that I do my best work when I can really concentrate it on a small goal, a smallish goal, mm-hmm. like 1,000 or 1,500 words. And however long that takes me is however long it takes me. And it's usually a morning or an afternoon. And then the other segment of the day, I'll work on something completely different for which I have a different reservoir of stuff, mm-hmm. and maybe do 4 or 5 pages of a script and see what happens. Or if I'm revising, I'll be writing and then revising something else. It's just so that I can keep my brain differently exercised.
So it's sort of a fatigue in one direction only,
and let then
it go. You're fresh in another direction.
That's the idea. Yeah. Often I'm just fatigued, full stop. But that's the idea, because I really feel like I will peter out if I've gone on too long.
Do you like to have more than one project going at all times? More than one creative project going at one time?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of wish I didn't. Mm. I mean, I got the books took off quite late for me. I mean, I started getting successful with books in my late 30s, and so. Anybody who says that they're happier that they got successful later is a liar. Of course, it would be great to be successful when I was 21, you know, but I did it then, you know. But getting successful later has its benefits, one of which is I never take anything for granted. I know how much hard work it took and how much luck and timing and so on. But it does a little bit, you think, okay, well, I've got these opportunities now, so I'm going to take them. I'll take them as long as they last. So there is a bit of a gigantic Protestant ticking clock there that I, you know, try to work to. But and it can drive me... It can drive me a bit around the bend. I've got to watch it, because I can get overcommitted and snap. so I'm getting a little better.
And how do you manage all the... Because there's been quite a lot of comments with the rise of writers' festivals like the one you're in today, and sort of the seemingly ever-increasing demands on the publicity cycle around any book. And then there's the German edition that comes out, and then there's editions all over the world that sort of, and you could kind of end up doing touring as your job, as your only job. Are you very tight with that and manage, keep a hand on that, or are you?
Well, I mean, gosh, nobody tours that much.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, authors might have complained loudly to you about it, but nobody tours that much. And so, you know, just be quiet, honestly. It's don't be ridiculous. If you're lucky enough to tour, shut up. You know?
and if you're lucky enough to go to a writer's festival, then you go along.
Yeah. I mean, and of course, it does take up some time, but you need to sell the book, and your publishers are risking money and resources on you, and you want to help them, and you want to, I don't know, I I think writers can complain about a lot of stuff, but having to do publicity, come on, quit whining. So, oh gosh, what a pain it is to be successful. Please, please, you're the luckiest teeny tiny nth of a percent in the world. Just shut up and smile.
Patrick, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us. It's been absolutely wonderful. We've learned so much.
It's
such a short little period.
Well, I'm jet lagged, so God knows what I said.
It was all great.
And then get hold of Patrick's books at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.